Hey y'all, Dr. Nadina Rozier will be joining us at Woke at Work, and she's the Managing Director and Head of Health Benefits Pharmacy at a global consultancy. Join us as she talks to us about the healthcare industry, advocacy, and forging your own path.
We are so delighted to welcome to the show Dr. Nadina Rozier, who is the Managing Director and Head of Health and Benefits for Pharmacy at a global consultancy. That is a title. Nadina and I met because we serve on a board together for one of my favorite organizations that I rep all the time, Reed 718. Nadina and I sat down to talk about the board and get her onboarded, and we had the best conversation. And I was like, I need you on my podcast so that we could bring all that awesomeness to our listeners. So, Nadina, welcome.
Thank you.
And I just gave a little bit of an introduction, but we really like to invite our guests to introduce themselves with whatever identity markers feel important to you. Tell the listeners who you are.
Sure. Well, hello, everybody. And thank you again for letting me participate. This is such an exciting topic, so relevant, so underrepresented in various conversations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But obviously, I'm a woman, specifically a proud woman of color. I'm also ethnically ambiguous when you look at me. So my actual heritage is African-American, Scottish, as well as Filipino and Spanish. So I check off
an
awful lot of boxes, which, you know, creates an interesting dynamic in the workplace and also personally. But, you know, certainly I think that's also part of my journey and an important part of my journey that I don't try to hide in any way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you're mentioning journey. So can you tell us and tell our folks who are listening, what, you know, a little bit about your journey? How have you gotten to where you are today?
Sure. So if women of color are underrepresented just in corporate America generally, even in my own specific field as a chemist and a scientist, it's even more distinct. So I started off as a chemist, a physical chemist at that. I think I was one of six women who had advanced degrees in physical chemistry when I finished. And then I decided to pursue a doctorate, and I opted to go from one of the universities in California, UC San Diego, to Howard University. I always wanted to go to a historically Black university at the time that...
Shout out HBCU!
Bison love. At the time that my father was matriculating through university, he didn't really have a choice. He had to go to an HBCU, and I felt as though, as part of my journey, I wanted to make that choice, that I could have gone to any university. I could have gone to Harvard. I could have gone to Stanford. I could have gone really anywhere. I was young when I went to college. I was turning 16 in my first freshman year. So I could write my ticket and go wherever I wanted to. But I chose an HBCU, and I thought that that was important. And I always tell women that are seeking a college education that the difference between going to UC San Diego and going to Howard is that at UC San Diego, I don't think it was necessarily malicious, but on some level, regardless of race, they expect you to fail. And they do that test at orientation where they say, look to your right and look to your left.
Yeah.
One of you
won't
be here.
Yeah.
At an HBCU, or at least at Howard, when you go to convocation, that's what they call it when you get there. But they don't do that exercise. They hope that the person to your right and the person to your left is going to get there, not only on their own accord, but because you are going to help
them
get there.
That's exactly what I was going to say. The language of that kind of thing is probably very different. Look to your left, look to your right. You are your brother's, your sister's keeper. Make sure this person is here next year.
Absolutely.
That's totally different
individualism
experience.
Individualism versus collective group.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, kind of coming back to my journey, I don't mean to be long-winded, but, you know, circling back to the journey, why that's important is that at UC San Diego, I felt as though, and again, this is not isolated to just that university. I think in that environment, there was an expectation of failure, and somehow that was that I think the end result or intention was supposed to be pride, that you were one of the three that survived. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I went to Howard, I was expected to succeed.
Wow.
And so there was pride in that.
Yes.
And so that, I think, has had a much greater impact on my journey and my story, mm-hmm. And certainly my corporate survival and kind of, you know, matriculating through the ranks than actually any other experience.
And shout out HBCU.
Yes.
Me think a lot about just... I know we're going to get back to your journey, too, but it does make me think about how being one of few, there is this idea of I already don't know if I'm going to make it because there are not that many of us here. And so, right, it's like what Claude Steele, like the stereotype threat, right? Like as a woman in science, then as a person of color in higher ed, now combine the two as a woman of color, like, am I going to fail in the back of my mind? And I'm not going to fail. I'm not going to fail, but nobody else is here with me.
Right.
Right.
And so how that plays out in some of our, you know, in our roles.
And it's a lonely place, you know, yeah. and it only gets worse as you become an executive. And it was one piece of advice, a very senior member within, you know, the company that I work for, you know, said it's going to be lonely at the top and you should just know that. And he said, and particularly someone walking in your high heels, that's not only physically uncomfortable, but you're going to find that you will need to take a much more purposeful step in finding people that you can relate to and that you can have these conversations, because to be alone is one thing, but to be lonely is something completely different.
Absolutely. I love how you said, you know, in talking about your journey, that you felt that your time at Howard was maybe the most pivotal step in preparing you for what was next. I've tried so hard to communicate this to people when they talk about HBCUs and they say, oh, but, you know, it's not diverse enough. And I'm like, first of all, what do you mean by diverse?
Sure.
When I went to Spelman, it was one of the most diverse experiences I've ever had in my life. I mean, there were women from everywhere, all across the diaspora. They were rich, they were poor, they were country, they were city, they were hood, they were bougie, like, I mean, whatever there was. And I had never been surrounded by so much diversity. And I say, and I've heard so many other people say, that experience, it girded me for what I was going to be dealing with when I went out into a world that was quote unquote diverse, because of the things that were spoken into me, the things that I learned about myself, my heritage, my sisters, all of those things. I was prepared. I left Spelman with the confidence that I don't know if I would have gotten at a predominantly white institution. I've been trying. I have two girls, one in college, one on her way to college. Mm-hmm. They won't hear me when I tell them this. I'm like, can you please go to Howard? Can you please go to Spelman? And they're not listening to me right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, it's definitely not an experience for everyone, just like, say, Harvard or, you know, any other school, Dartmouth, where my ex-husband went. You know, it's not an experience or a school for everyone, but I fundamentally believe that being in an environment where people have a vested interest and a purpose behind making sure you are successful, that feeling doesn't go away. And so you walk into every situation, I think, mm-hmm. with that supportive backdrop.
100.
So the conversation changes. And you're right. I think I became most confident, not only because I was moving from California to D.C. on my own, but also because every day that I woke up, I there was pride in that I chose to be here and everybody around me wants me to be here.
So how did you move from being a physical chemist, as you described it, to the work that you do now in a more corporate, you know, kind of environment?
Yeah, I've always been someone that says, you know, you don't have to follow a very traditional path to find what your passion is. There's so many different ways to get to your end goal and whatever way you define as success and happiness. And we're finding, you know, as a consultancy, we conduct many surveys and we find that there are more and more children that are growing up where a college education won't actually even be required or necessary, that 60% of the jobs in the next 5-10 years don't exist right now.
Interesting.
So I have always been one that advises people, create your path. You can either follow someone else's because, you know that's tried and true and it has a track record that shouldn't be ignored. But that shouldn't stifle your own goals and your own desires to pursue something different. So in my path, I started off as a chemist. I then got a doctorate degree in pharmacy and then did a residency. But I still knew that I was not going to work in a hospital because I didn't want to be surrounded by sick people.
Sorry, I'm a little under the weather today. You're surrounded by sick people. Right. With me.
Like,
I
could have benefited you now.
Exactly. But I loved the chemistry behind medications, and I did want to help people. I wanted to contribute to society in a specific way, and that was ingrained upon me by both of my parents. And so I said, well, I don't want to be a traditional pharmacist, but I like the concept of not just treating hundreds of thousands of people in my career, but what if I could touch millions of people? And so I went into consulting in advising really large employers around how to develop their healthcare benefits strategy. Okay. So the benefits that they provide to their employees is much more than just, here's the pharmacy you go to, or hey, you can go to this physician or this hospital's in network versus not. I mean, at a tactical level, yes, there is some of that. But more broadly for me, it filled a passion in terms of helping patients navigate a very broken healthcare system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when you have such a broad desire or you start off with a big goal such as that, because that's fairly lofty for, you know, a little woman like me, you find that you now have opened the door to have thousands of paths. Mm. Instead of saying, I want to be a doctor, or I want to be a chemist, or I want to be a lawyer, which is very common, mm-hmm. I think. But I think generationally, we will see a shift where our children and our children's children mm-hmm. will not have those same goals. They will have the larger than life. I want to address climate change.
Yeah.
Or hopefully my daughter will say, I want to fix the healthcare system, which, you know, certainly is my passion. Doesn't have to be hers. But I've always tried to encourage that in our journeys, make them big, bigger than life, because then you have an opportunity to formulate a path that maybe you're the first to venture on.
That's so great.
Yeah. So you mentioned, so break it down for people who are like, well, what is it like? Like, describe the environment in which you work. Because I think it is, while you are clearly talking about a specific space, there is an environment that I think is transferable for many of us women of color that is not just unique to your space. So what does it look like? What is it like? What are the people? I don't know if you break it down to percentages, but like, what does it look like? And who are the people you engage with on your day to day or week to week?
Yeah. So my team is in three different countries. They are all spread out. So for my specific practice, it is 90% women, which is not reflective of most practices. I would say over a third are people of color in my practice. Again, not reflective of what you hear in surveys done by other consultancies around the percentage of people of color, let alone women of color in the workplace. And so that's also not reflective of our company, which has, you know, thousands of people globally across, you know, over 40 different countries. So when you look around as a person of color, you don't see very many that look like you.
Yeah.
And I think that you can approach that and say, oh, my goodness, I'm one of very few. What do I do? Or you can feel empowered by it and say, hey, I'm one of very few. I can turn good intentions into actual action.
Yeah.
So I can be that strong advocate for people because there aren't that many of us. And so that voice could potentially get lost, not in just a big office, but in a global firm like ours.
Yeah.
And so when I came into the company, I was relatively senior already. I came from another rival consultancy in New York City. And what strikes me is that over the course of 5 years, this conversation around the importance of diversity inclusion is just now being an area of focus. Mm-hmm. It's been around forever.
Oh, yeah. Right. But, you Absolutely. Know, that I think I saw something one time that kind of laid out the way these things, these conversations come into the mainstream. And it was like, well, this group, you know, protesters, you know, advocates, they will start the conversation, right? And it's right there. And then at some point, academia picks it up. And then, you know, maybe a couple years later, corporate America starts to pick it up. And then politicians. And it's like, it's on this schedule, it seems, of when, like, oh, this is a thing, you know, oh, Black Lives Matter. Like, where did this come from? Diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so to your point, it's been in the atmosphere and a topic of conversation for forever, really. I mean, gosh, back in the 70s, people were having these conversations. But we're just now starting to see it reflected, I feel like, in corporate America, where it seems like now people are rushing and falling over themselves to try to fill DEI positions. Like, oh, that's a position. Right. We don't have that. We need that.
Right. You have to, and I think in my role, what folks don't understand is that you need to ensure that diversity inclusion ties to a business imperative. You have to understand that that yields business results. We're not just doing diversity inclusion as a hobby.
Yeah.
That there's a reason that the Corporate Equality Index is an important measure of how socially responsible and how, you know, engaged they are on this topic, because it actually will result in better business.
Yeah.
So I think once you tie this, all of these concepts around the importance of managing, mentoring, engaging women of color, and you realize that your business as a company will thrive if you do that, then the conversation, I think, becomes easier, because oftentimes there are many companies, particularly in certain industries, that are very bottom line driven. They don't want to hear anything fluffy. They're very focused on what's the ROI.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to have a different conversation around diversity and inclusion, I think, has been really critically important in my job, and how I speak to clients and advise them has now been different, because it touches almost every aspect of our life. There are social determinants of health that are connected to race and how people use healthcare services, how people seek care, the quality of the care that they receive, their incomes relate to what type of healthcare and the disease burden that they have. And so, again, having that more comprehensive conversation, I think that has changed dramatically over time.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that you're making me think about, too, is like when I think of corporate America, and I've never worked in corporate America, so I'll just put that out there. I also think it's a male dominated space. Right. So and then I have worked in sectors where people talk about equity, and equity is not just race. Equity is gender. Equity is like all these other right identity markers.
Yeah.
Sure.
So I can imagine that when corporate America is talking about equity and then you're talking about global marketing, like never mind that there are cultural differences in how men and women are treated, that sometimes the gender piece is not, I won't say a distraction, but is an added layer and therefore race, the racial element, I wonder if it takes, it's just a second seat. And so for women of color, for a woman of color, it's like, can I really separate these two? Like, for me, it's like I am one of the few women and I am the only woman of color, right? Or I am one of the two women of color.
So. Yeah, you feel as though you don't fit neatly into either box. I think our company did actually the opposite. They decided to double down on women when they talked about gender equity and certainly pay equity. So that has been one of our critical pillars, in addition to multicultural inclusion and just general inclusion around how people identify, right? So we've added pronouns to our signatures in terms of how we identify. Mm. But you're absolutely right. I think when you are a woman, there's a set of experiences that come along being a woman, regardless of race. And I feel like, at least personally, I don't fit neatly in that bucket. I'm a single mother. So I'm not married, so I don't engage in those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I am also a woman of color. So a lot of the women that are driving change and are, you know, significant activists don't necessarily look like me.
Yeah.
And then in the women of color or in the people of color space, I don't fit neatly in one race. I am biracial or, you know, quadriracial, it seems. Thank you, Ancestry DNA. But that also informs a certain set of, you know, direction and a lack of kind of feeling as though I fit in that box. And so I'm constantly straddling and trying to determine, well, where is it that I can add to the conversation?
Yeah.
And where can I then advocate for others? Because sometimes I'm advocating for women generally,
mm-hmm.
and I'm also advocating for people of color.
Right. I read a study that talked about, you know, women of color in this country make up about 36% of the population. Black women in particular only make up, and we had this conversation, about 11 to 12% of leadership, according to Catalyst, leadership roles. But you and I talked about the fact that the higher you go mm-hmm. up, when you talk about the C-suite, you're talking more like 4% there.
Right.
But this same study also highlighted the fact that it's not for a lack of education. We're well prepared, mm-hmm. the most educated group in the country. And it's not for lack of ambition. 81% of women in this study, women of color, express the desire to move up, you know, the corporate ladder, express that they were interested in more senior roles. And so it's such a huge gap between our preparedness and our ambition to do it and those of us who are actually given the opportunity. What do you attribute that to? And then what do you see as your role or responsibility, you know, as a senior executive, Dr. Nadina? What is your role and responsibility in bringing other women of color along with you?
Sure. I cannot stress enough the importance of understanding there is a difference between mentorship and sponsorship. And I think that women in women of color in general are hesitant about pursuing those types of relationships. I think other races of people and other genders have a tendency to be far more aggressive or assertive.
You're talking about white men?
Yes.
Yes. Other genders, I'm going to go with men.
Yes. They are much more confident in a room, regardless of competency, mind you, because you did highlight
100%.
The fact that we are the most educated group of women,
Our
educated group,
right.
I should say, on the planet. But so they have no problem with their competency. That doesn't even enter their minds when they do the ask, for a mentor or a sponsor. And so I think we have to get over that hurdle in a way that allows us to engage and reach out to senior people. And at the same time, I think senior executives have to find some level of responsibility, again, tying to, you know, business results. This is a business imperative, not a hobby that we've or some sort of thing that we've socially constructed because we were bored.
Or even because it feels good or it's the right thing to do. I was talking to someone else recently that said that only lasts for so long. You know, this altruistic, emotional, you know, impetus to attend to DEI. It has to be tied to business goals and health for, you know, a number of people in order to take it on. But go ahead.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, my daughter, Logan, she had a middle school chemistry test and she said, like seeks like. And that was her way of remembering polarity. And so I said, that's true. I mean, at the end of the day, if you don't see an executive that looks like you walking around the office or engaging an audience in a way that, you know, clicks and resonates, you may not seek a mentor. You may say, we're not going to have anything in common. And that assumption, I think, holds a number of people back. But at the executive level, I think we also have a responsibility to do the pull through. Because, again, not because we're just being kind or because this is a personal goal of ours or just some sort of desire. I have that desire because I think it's critically important. You can't be an executive without some sort of succession plan and training the next crop of leaders. And I want the best and the brightest. So if, in fact, people of color are highly educated and competent, then why wouldn't I invest
Absolutely.
The time and energy to do that?
I mean, it just makes me think about the added responsibility and weight that we carry, right? Like, it's just, right. I can't even enjoy this movement in here because, like at an HBCU, it's not just for me, right?
No,
this
right.
is not an individual move. This is a collective, like, I'm doing this for others, right? And to make the way. And, you know, it's like that... That article that was around about like the mothers, how mothers carry this like this additional responsibility that people, you know, like don't always, and it's emotional labor. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Emotional labor. And it's just, while it's something even, you know, in the positions that I've moved up in, you know, it wasn't ever just about, none of those were driven by self like desire. It was about making a path additional, you know, an additional path for someone else. And so, when you think about, you know, this corporate America and white men, you know, don't have to think about that, right? Like, so I don't have to ask for it, or maybe I can ask for it because look at all the number of people, and like for us, it's like it's only one of you. I'm gonna get like 10 requests for people to do this, right? And
right.
I don't know if that's like your reality.
No, absolutely. And I think we also have to recognize that everyone has unconscious bias. So we're constantly bumping up against anyone's preconceived notions.
Yeah.
You know, I remember a woman told this younger analyst, let's stop with the angry black woman trope. Let's just get in front of that. And I was so proud to hear that she was, you know, asserting that and acknowledging that we're not going to have you narrate some story that's not relevant here.
Mm.
And everyone comes with that unconscious bias, but it's even more evident when you are a woman of color, as opposed to being a white man. Like,
yeah.
There's not really, that doesn't necessarily happen in your face as often as it does for us.
But you said something that I thought was really important in a conversation we had, and you talked about how people of color have to also be willing to ask for mentorship, sponsorship, you know, from people who are not people of color,
right?
I mean, I think that, like you said, like attracts like.
Yes, yes.
Right, and so that's great. Like, I definitely gravitate towards the women of color in my orbit who are doing the thing that I think I want to do or doing the thing that I think I could do, but when we are in positions and environments where that doesn't exist, we can't limit ourselves and say, you know, if my director is a white woman and I think I want to be a director one day, I also have to be willing and open to receiving guidance from that person as well. And I thought that was really interesting, because I think that we tend to be much more comfortable with people who share our race, share our gender, share our cultural background, but we're going to limit ourselves if that's the extent of who we're willing to seek guidance from.
No, absolutely. And I always tell young women, have an ask. You know, don't just seek a mentor or some sort of sponsor, but what is your ask? What is it that you want that person to do? Are you seeking advice or guidance about a specific situation? Do you want them to have a longer term relationship with you because you're trying to truly evolve your career? Maybe you're at a point in your life where, you know, I was not too long ago, where you're saying, I've been successful, but now I want to pivot.
Yeah.
So I think those are the types of relationships that you build over time with someone that you can connect with. But I always think it's important that we as women have an ask, because men have no problem, like I said, asking. It's not a function of their competency. They don't care if it's their level.
Yeah.
Millennials, some individuals in the company think they should be CEO in 3 years. Hey, I've worked here 3 years. Why am I not CEO by now?
What did we do to raise them like that? Like, that's what, I mean, I'm a millennial by the very last year.
I'm like,
how did that happen? Because they come in like, oh, you get this number of days off? I should get that number of days off.
Right.
Oh, you get that title? I deserve, like, there is no respecter of
persons or level, which on one hand I think is really badass. On the other hand, when it's happening to me, I'm like, who do you think you are?
Right? Empowerment gone wrong. Right? Right. Like, I'm, that's the same thing I talk about. I talk about my daughter. I empower you. You are a woman of color. You will learn to speak, just not in my house. Learn to talk outside, not inside.
No, I admire the confidence, but sometimes you're right. It is oftentimes misplaced. And so you have to kind of take that compass and move it back north. But
do you ever struggle when you're advocating for women of color and you're trying to bring them along to make sure we can grow that number of women in leadership and women of color in the C-suite? Do you ever struggle with any kind of, I don't know, guilt or even worry about what it is you're bringing them into? Because it's not easy, as you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, we were talking about this earlier, that it's difficult because we have crystal balls. We know exactly what that looks like.
Yeah.
And you can only describe it so much, and you hope that all you can do, not dissimilar to your children, you know, all you can do is give them the tools and try to prepare them as best you can.
Yeah.
And hopefully give them the benefit of your wisdom and hindsight and, you know, the fact that you could see in that rearview mirror what's going to happen. But ultimately, individuals and women have to make a choice about how they want to navigate in their careers. And sometimes they will fumble. And sometimes they'll leave. They'll say, forget it. You didn't tell me that this was going to be that hard. Or maybe I did tell you it was going to be that hard, but you needed to see it for yourself.
Yeah.
And so you're right. It's a constant teetering between, you know, how direct can I be? How forthright can I be? But at the same time, give them the leeway and flexibility to make their own choices.
Right, because you don't want to scare them off. Like, you're trying to increase representation. But at the same, you know, I left a place recently and I knew I was being replaced by another woman of color. And on the one hand, I wanted it to be that way because I really feel like a woman of color in that role is what's needed. On the other hand, I was like, this, like, don't do it, you know. They're not ready,
or that's what she needs at that moment to learn and grow. And like, you know, you learned in the way you learned, you were, you know, like, I'm gonna move on from here, what it does make me think of too is that there is this idea of choice, right? Like, we can choose to walk away, right? But for some, and there's also a piece of confidence with that.
Sure.
Like, I'm trying to bring you into this. And then this person goes into the role and they're like, yeah, you said it was hard, but you didn't look like it was hard. Like, you didn't physically look like you were struggling. You were like, I'm not even bathing every night. I don't, you know, like all the stresses that come with it. Right. And so I just wonder, you know, like, what in a space, in a field that already started out, I mean, chemistry and all of that stuff. Like, I don't even know what chemists do, but that's kind of dope to say that you were a chemist. I just mix stuff together in science class. Yeah. That's all I remember. But that was already few women, few people of color, right? Was that always an intrinsic confidence? Was there like self-talk? Is there a mantra? Like, what do you end up, how did you get there?
Yeah, because we were like, what about imposter syndrome? It was like, oh, no, that's not my problem.
Imposter syndrome? You don't have imposter syndrome.
You're
surrounded by number white men.
I know. It's. I think it's because, I mean, my father, you know, all disclosure, was a black CEO. So I had a very compelling role model in my life. So I think also the fact that he was of a different gender, obviously, you know, being a man and, you know, raising a daughter. I think that is what really laid the foundation, that because now I can be that because I saw it. I grew up with it. And I saw all of the trials and tribulations that it took to start a business. He's been an executive in multiple businesses and then to obviously run his own company. I think that is what gave me, you know, the confidence to effectively stand on my own two feet. And he gave me the same advice that I'm giving to every other woman, which is the advice around mentorship, around don't follow someone's path, go create it. If they don't have your job, then go create it, which is what I'm doing now, oddly enough. And so as long as you understand what your ultimate goal is and keep it as broad as possible and you surround yourself with admirable, inspiring, and supportive people, both men and women. I think that then informs how you navigate those tough waters.
How you show up in a space,
and how you show up.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing I've really missed during quarantine is all the great classes I used to take. Right before lockdown started, I'd started a calligraphy class at my favorite craft store just because it was something I loved.
I hear you, and I also miss being able to connect with people and just learn new skills. Thankfully, that's why Skillshare is so great. Skillshare is an online learning community with thousands of inspiring classes for creative people like you and curious people like me.
They offer creative classes designed for real life and all the circumstances that come with it. Their lessons can help you stay inspired, express yourself, and introduce you to a community of millions.
Skillshare is also incredibly affordable. The annual subscription is just less than $10 a month.
Oh, wow. I just took a class taught by one of my favorite designers, Ade Hogue, called Lettering for Self-Expression. I couldn't believe it when I saw Ade had a set of classes on Skillshare because he had actually created a beautiful mural for a nonprofit I worked for. His lessons on beautiful, unique handwriting were exactly what I'd been missing.
Explore your creativity and get 2 free months of premium membership at Skillshare.com/woke, W-O-K-E. That's 2 whole months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free.
Get started and join today by heading to Skillshare.com/W-O-K-E. That's 2 free months of unlimited access to thousands of classes at Skillshare.com/woke. Wow!
So, Dr. Nadina, we have something we like to do where we ask guests to share a wow story. So, something that happened that you're like, wow, I can't believe that just happened to me. Or like, wow, did she just say that? Or did he just say that? So, we would love to know, like, what is your wow story and how did you deal with it? What happened afterwards? So.
There have been so many. How do you choose? So this happened 10 years ago. I had just been promoted into my role. So I was brand new, didn't know any of the other, executives that were named to their roles because, again, all of us were fairly new. We had just gone through a merger. And we decided, I won't say the state, but we decided to all kind of converge onto one office that seemed to be equally distant from the executives that were attending. I'll be purposely vague. And the market leader in the office, they were very adamant that they wanted to give all of the senior leaders a swag bag or going away gift or welcoming gift, whatever you want to call it, because this is the wow. And so we said, oh, that's so very nice. And so you probably guess where this is, but I'll tell you what was in the bag. So I get to the office early because, I mean, most women of color get there an hour before everybody 100%. Else. Let's just be clear.
I thought it was just me.
Just to
I
be
started
clear.
Coming late just because.
But then you stayed 2 hours late, so that doesn't really count.
Nobody needs to see that, though.
Exactly. So I get there early, and lo and behold, I see the bag. So I'm excited. I said, oh, there's going to be swag. So there was a lot of barbecue-type stuff. So whatever you would need for a grill, they had that in the bag. They had barbecue sauce, mustard, and they then also had bandanas for everybody. And every bandana had a different flag. So there were flags of different
states. This is
states.
Feeling bad.
No.
So the bag that was assigned to me, I open it up, and the bandana is a Confederate flag.
Stop the effing presses.
So I, again, didn't know. So I said, okay, let me take a minute. Maybe everybody got the same flag.
No, not everyone did.
So let me walk over to Mary's bag. So I go over to Mary's seat
Mary
and I open up
at her desk. Are you checking in her bag?
In her bag. And she has a normal kind of bag with
like a buffalo on it, or
it had some sort of flower with a leaf or something. I said,
did she have the grilling stuff in it?
She had the grilling.
Oh, okay, all right.
The bag was assigned to you.
The bag was in the seat that I had been sitting in the entire meeting over the course of the 2 days.
Oh my God.
It doesn't even matter.
We don't rotate.
Like, you should have skipped that state.
Why is that in
what are we doing?
Why is that in anybody's bag? Why was that even a consideration?
Oh my gosh.
And so I had two options. I could just take it out and go, you know, and go get another bag, or I could say, you know, I'm going to say something. Well,
yes. Option three, kick someone's ass.
Right. You know, yeah, we could do that too. Or, yeah. So I took a breath and I then told the most senior person, who happened to be one of my sponsors and a mentor. And I said, look here. I said, and it was the first leadership meeting I had ever gone to. I said,
right,
if
off the
this bat is foreboding, we're going to need to have a talk. And I showed him the flag and he was appalled.
Oh, my gosh.
I think that person's promotion might have been delayed. But that was my wow moment.
Oh, that's
a good wow. That's a good wow.
You can't even make that up.
No, you can't.
That's like not a wow. That's a no.
Right? Yeah.
No.
Like if I saw that on The Office, like an episode of The Office, I'd be like, that's over the top.
No, yeah. It happened.
Yes.
Right,
it
real
happened.
Life.
It happened.
How
Absolutely.
Did you keep it? First of all, I'm impressed that you kept your composure. And really, going back to our conversation about advocacy, that you were confident enough to advocate for yourself in that moment. Because some people might have chosen to take the flag out, tuck it, you know, in their bag,
text
throw it away.
Text somebody about it.
Text somebody about it, or just like chalk it up to, this is the tax I pay for being a person of color at such a high level. But that you weren't willing to accept that and went to the person, your sponsor, as you said, and was like, This thing happened, and if this is an indication of what it's going to be like to work here, I'm concerned.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I was very proud that he even seemed just as livid as I was.
Yeah.
I think because we were just both in shock. I mean, again, it's a wow moment regardless of your race or gender, but it was appalling.
Yeah.
And the fact that seemed to be okay, but it also opened up the conversation around, you know, the individual that let this happen. It opened up the conversation around, well, so why did he ever think that would be okay? And so we started to say, well, was that a joke? That's a bad joke. Was that just really you were that ignorant
that
you
privileged?
Didn't think and that privilege that you thought, oh, this isn't a big deal. This is a part of our history. If I've got to hear that one more time, one more again.
Did you ever have a conversation with that person, or do you know that someone did?
Oh, someone did because the promotion was delayed. Because I said, if this is what we're promoting, I said, then we have a really big problem because it's not just about our numbers. It's and if he's done it to a senior person like I was or I am, then who else has he made feel uncomfortable? And I don't want to make this a witch hunt and start surveying every person of color that works for him. I said, but if we are saying that this doesn't matter, as egregious as it is, and, you know, so, of course, I've told this story to others just to get their feedback, other mentors, and they said, that person could be fired. You could go to HR. And I don't want to kill this person's career, but not yet. Should you test me one more time?
Right.
You only got one time to do that. And I was relatively young at that point. I still am young, I feel. But,
yes.
You know, I was much younger.
Great.
So I think that, you know, it was just telling. But I was very proud of the way that our leadership team handled it.
Wow. Great
wow
story.
Wow is right.
Right?
Know, right?
You shouldn't have to have a person of color in the room to notice that.
Yeah. And someone, you know, going back to the earlier comment about what was my ask or always have an ask, because someone said, okay, so what, this happened, not so what, but okay, now what, this happened, are you seeking an apology? I said, no. How do you apologize that you had, that you committed a racist act? Like, how do you apologize for that? I think my ask of him was, number one, I can't sign off on promotion. So if I get outnumbered, but of course, my supporters on the team also did not sign off on it. But I said, I think I want to better understand, or I need some clarity. I think we all do, for his sake, around, is this something that he truly feels is okay? Because he can take one of two postures too, right? Yeah. He can go on the defensive, which is your natural human state, right. If someone's accusing you of something that is racist or that you might be a bigot, then of course your instinct is to say, well, no, I can't believe you said that. You know, I didn't. So he could do that, uh-huh. or he could plead ignorance and say, oh, well, I didn't know, which then also makes you an idiot. Or he could just be completely of the mindset, mea culpa, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
And so I think he was able to provide clarity that it was a mistake. And to his credit, he acknowledged it. He said, I should have actually looked. I personally did not feel that bad. This was not a joke. Mm. And I will make sure going forward that I check myself and I take the additional step, because even in his, I think in his mind, he said, it never occurred to me that, you know, that could have been a possible flag. And I said, even in the South, never thought about it.
Yeah.
So,
but that's the case with so many people.
Yeah.
That's what I'm always pushing people, when I'm doing DEI work. Like, for me, the question is always just asking yourself questions. Like, I don't expect people to know all the things and to always get it right and to be so fully steeped in what it means to be a person of color in this country that you don't ever make any mistakes. That's not the expectation.
Right.
But are you asking yourself the question, what could I be missing here? You know, what do I need to consider that is not a first consideration for me, but now it needs to be? Like, what could be going on? And for that person, it could have been, okay, I've got this activity. Where are my blind spots? Right? Like, I want to fill these bags. What could possibly be offensive or go wrong that I'm not seeing on a first pass? Take a second look, and then take a third look, and then ask somebody else to look as well.
And then make sure you're telling the people, make sure that these bags are not, like, here are all the things you now need to think. If I'm managing a team of people, then I'm like, make sure that this is happening, right? It does make me think of, like, all those questions that we ask ourselves. Folks of color and women of color, and I don't know what's in white folks' mind, and like, so I don't know. But like, the amount of self-talk and questions I ask before I go into anything, am I dressed a certain way? Am I, like, how is this going to land?
What's
how am I, like,
look
all
like?
Of these things that I think about before I do think about this, like, with anyone who's in a marginalized group going into a dominant space. We have those conversations, right?
100%.
Like, we have those internal conversations, and some of the moves that we make are intentional, and some of them are, like, you know, very premeditated and, like, you know, and so I do feel like those, when I think of the equity work that I do, it's like, there is this, am I thinking about this through a racialized lens, right?
That's
and so,
the question.
Like, a racialized lens to develop that, and not, I don't know how to not think that way, right? I just think that way naturally. For folks to develop that and fine tune that is important. Like, it's just part of the work, right?
Yeah.
And how in the midst of all of this code switching and considering and thinking, do you not try not to lose yourself, right? Because there's something authentic and genuine about, you know, who I am as a person, but I oftentimes have to think about, well, how is that going to come across? So even in the conversation, even when I told the senior person in the room that this happened, you're right. My knee-jerk reaction, you know, the hood in me was
like,
to say,
wait.
You are out of your mind.
Right?
No
Have
way.
You lost your mind?
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
Said,
no, not today, devil.
Ew,
not today.
Right.
Was getting his ass kicked.
Right.
Like, that was a third option.
Right.
Oh, my God.
That sounded like
right.
the first one.
Right.
Okay, so we've come to the part of our show where we like to do like a Dear Abby column, except we call it Dear Woke at Work. And we invite a listener to send us a letter with a problem of practice or an issue they're facing. And we try to give a little bit of advice. So today's letter comes from Megan in Southern California. And Megan says, Dear Woke at Work, I am a 29-year-old African-American professional working in Southern California. I have been seeing the latest news about the alarming disparities in maternal health, maternal deaths for women of color. I've also read literature about how beneficial it can be for women of color to see healthcare practitioners who are of their same racial background. I understand how this may alleviate some of the bias we experience, but given where I live, there aren't really any options for me to do that. What is your advice for how I can best advocate for myself when seeking medical care from those who may be predisposed to biases about me?
That's a heavy letter.
That is. I was just reading, I was listening to a podcast, and I reference this podcast all the time on my social because I think it's brilliant. It's called Hidden Brain by NPR. And they were doing, Shankar was doing an episode. Gosh, I forget what the title of it was, but it was all about this question of should we be purposely seeking medical attention from people who look like us? It was a really provocative question, and he comes at everything from a really scientific way. So he had all kinds of data to show and support how this may be beneficial and exactly what cases it is. And so because of that, I literally changed all my doctors. Like,
oh, interesting.
I really did. I started Googling, like, Black doctor, mm-hmm. Black pediatrician, Black obstetrician, Black female, you know, family care doctor. I went and saw, maybe the only Black female cardiologist in this particular part of Brooklyn, but I found her, and I went there because I was so convinced after listening to that podcast that it might make the difference for me between life or death. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the decision that I made for me and for my family whenever possible. I go see a pulmonologist because I have asthma, who is a little white Jewish man, old Jewish man in
Lungs, huh?
Huh?
He take care of them lungs. You
I
keep
mean,
going back
he's
to him.
My, right. He may be my right. favorite doctor. I mean, he's got excellent bedside manner. He's everything that you're looking for in a doctor. So, you know, that's not my only, it's like, oh, I won't see you if you're not a person of color. It's not that. But after listening to that podcast, I was kind of convinced that it might matter. So I feel for her. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel as though when you live in a rural area and you don't have the opportunity to find, you know, physicians, let alone find someone that looks and breathes and smells like you. it's a big challenge. It's a challenge that a number of employers feel when they're trying to give broad mm-hmm. access to healthcare to their employees. And so you'll start to see creep up over the next couple of years. These companies that are very focused on virtual medicine. You know, we talk mm-hmm. about telemedicine, telehealth. And that is to address the accessibility issue and provide high quality care, but for patients that perhaps may not be able to see someone in their actual hometown for their specific condition, because access is obviously critically important. It's difficult because as a clinician, you hope that you check some of those biases at the door. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when you are a person of color, as we had just talked about, there's a burden or there's this extra set of steps that we go through to make sure that we're educated on topics that impact us, because we know that's critically important. And so when you have a female physician that's African-American, then she's going to probably do more research around fibroids, as an example, because that tends to be very prevalent in our community, whereas someone, you know, that's the little white Jewish man, if he was your OBGYN, he may not necessarily understand some of the implications and how that impacts your life more broadly than just having the fibroid. Yeah. So even the quality of the care may be very different.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just made me think about, you just took me back to one time I had a female OBGYN. And then I had to have a procedure done, and it was done with a male doctor. And I was just all in my feelings about, like, why do I have to have a male? Like, I didn't know that, like, whatever, but the procedure needed to get done. Then at the end of it, he had a recommendation from, he's like, well, maybe this would stop if you did this. And it wasn't like stop eating stuff, you know, like, stop eating this. It was like completely do a different procedure. And I was like, who the hell are you, sir? sister, you have never had any of these organs, right? And so I was like, with all due respect, sir, I understand you have medical background, you have medical expertise, but you do not have a female expertise. I'm just giving you some advice. I was like, I'm good, unless it's a life or death situation. Like, mm-hmm. He was like, no, it just makes your life easier.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, what would make my life also easier is if you just told me different options and different impact of those options and giving me the freedom to choose rather than trying to pigeonhole or corner me into making one decision that you think is most convenient for, you know, like what you would think without even knowing what other impact it had. So
that's what I hear, like, in advocating for yourself, like being willing to speak up, right? And say, actually, these options don't fit, you know, my lifestyle or my desires right now. Or, you know, I was telling Nadina earlier, like, I am the queen of looking up what I think is wrong with me.
Absolutely.
Doing all the research on
girl.
It.
Right.
And then going in and talking with the doctor and saying, okay, but did you consider this? Or help me, if you say it's not this, help me understand why. Like, how do you know? Like, not being afraid to question and push back, because I love what you said. Like, we're paying for this, right?
You're a consumer.
Exactly.
Right. You forget that.
Yeah, we do.
Well, it's funny. My ex-husband, when we were married and had to go to hospitals, he would always dress up to go to the hospital.
Yes.
And
my grandmother did the same
thing. His parents told him. And I was sitting here in my, you know, athleisure wear because I'm going to the hospital and I need to have this procedure done. And so, of course, I want to be comfortable. But he showed up in his Xenia best because he knew. He said, they will treat us differently. He said, before you know it, they're going to try to donate your organs.
I can't even go to the doctor without the added thought.
It's
I'm like, what the heck?
What are you going to wear?
If I go up in there and I see somebody else in some athleisure, a white woman in athleisure, why the hell can't I just show up in athleisure?
But you know why.
I mean, I know why. Right. I know my friend, Melanie, who, you know, she is a lawyer by trade and showed, I was at the hospital and I was pregnant with my first child. And I thought it was clearly my first child because I was like, oh my God, I think I'm going into labor. And she ran and, she, you know, my husband was like, I'm on my way.
You're like, girl,
like
that's
all
gas.
Of these things. It was gas. Everybody was like, and then I started laughing. They were like, you are not going into labor. It's how you see it in the movies. But anyway, so she shows up and then someone knocks on the door. It's just me in the room. And she's like, your lawyer's here? And I was like, I have a lawyer?
Like, do I need a lawyer?
She came in a suit. And I was like, what? And I think she was at work. And she was like, no, you always tell people you have legal representation.
Absolutely.
I was like, oh my.
Interesting.
I just am trying to make sure I have a baby. And so, like, apparently dress up and, I mean, there's
and
another
takeaway. Say you have a
lawyer. Say you have a lawyer, y'all.
Right?
That's one way to advocate.
Yeah,
that's
not,
one way,
none
Megan.
Of, yeah. None
Megan
of my family
advocate.
And friends do that. They never go to the hospital without, you know, if I'm available. Then I said, "Are you're going to the hospital? I'll meet you there." Because having a clinician in the room that understands the language and the lingo, particularly if you are under the influence, so they might have given you some sort of opioid for some pain or something that makes you feel or seem loopy. It you always have to have somebody in your corner to advocate when you can't. And yes, I will be in a suit or dressed up when I show up. Just
same. I do the same
I
thing.
I
hate
it.
I'm mad at myself. But I know. I do. I
I'm going to the
up.
Hospital next time you go to the hospital. I'm showing up. I'm her personal clinician. I need to be here.
And I'll be the person be like, she don't need to be here.
Exactly. Right.
So, Megan, that's your answer. Like, I feel like our advice to Megan is to do your research, and no matter who you're going to see, you know, be prepared to ask questions, be prepared to advocate for yourself. And if you have someone in your corner who is a clinician or, you know, runs in those circles, like, don't be afraid to also bring somebody with you as a source of support. One last thing I will say, I had the best OB, maybe one of the best OBs I've ever had when I lived. I don't know where in Southern California Megan is living right now. She didn't specify, but when I lived in Laguna Niguel, he was a white man from New York. He was amazing.
Mm.
So you can get good care no matter who you go to, because to Nadina's point, they should be checking their biases at the door, but it doesn't help us to be prepared to advocate for ourselves, much like our sister Serena Williams had to do when she had her baby when the time comes. So Megan, thank you so much for your question. If you're out there listening and you want to send questions that may get read on the show, you can email wokeatwork@gmail.com or shoot us a DM on our Instagram, which is also wokeatwork. Affirmation.
So we like to end with some, like, we call it affirmation, but not like necessarily in a traditional, just words that you would want to leave for folks as they're listening to think about, because you've given us a lot of good nuggets. So what's something that you would say is your affirmation or your parting words?
Sure. Well, I celebrated my birthday recently, and my boss gave me a card that was so apropos, as I am also pivoting in my career, as is she. And it read, if you want something you never had, you have to do something you've never done. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was so appropriate in terms of advising me in her own special way to really forge your own path and create a journey for you. You don't necessarily have to follow someone else's, and not be afraid to kind of be yourself and, you know, effectively engage in your own life. We sometimes just live. But in order to thrive, you have to actively engage. And I fundamentally do believe that is the difference between joy and happiness. Joy is an active decision. Happiness, you know, can happen just passively. But that's just my own kind of opinion. But I think that is what I would leave every person of color, every person in general, to really make sure that they understand that they own their life.
Yes.
And don't allow other people to dictate and tell you, just, you know, similar to what you were saying, Blanca, about, you know, don't just give me one choice, you know, give me all the options that I have. The same holds true for your life.
Yes. I love that. Yeah. Actively engage in your own life. I never thought about it like that. Love that.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been a great conversation.
Gems of knowledge and truth. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so now looking back on our interview with Nadina, thinking about what really stood out and what I'm walking away with, for me, it was so many things. It's really hard to choose. I'll say just a couple.
We're supposed to agree to one.
I know, but it was just so much good stuff. Okay, first of all, not being afraid to advocate for yourself, whether or not you are visiting a hospital or a doctor's office, doing your research, coming with your questions, you know, asking for more options, and whether or not you are doing that or even confronting an instance of racism in your workplace and an issue of bias, whether it was intended or not, just not being afraid to name it and to have an ask even for that. Okay, so this is what I need. This is what I'm asking to be next steps behind that. That stood out to me. And then also this idea of mentorship and not limiting yourself to people who just look like you. You know, because if they're not in your orbit, you know, you can't just be like, oh, well, I guess it's not possible for me. No, go to the person who is in a position and have an ask for that as well. So those are my two. What about you, Blanca?
Yeah. I think the advocacy piece is so big. I guess I was struck on the HBCU connection and feeling like at Howard, she looked to her left and right and realized, you know, everybody, we're all in this together. And so as we move through our, you know, whatever career or job, whatever it is, as we're moving up, whatever that means, that it's not just about me, that it is about just what I'm, and it's a responsibility to shoulder, but also, and it is actually the movement of our people, is that we are communal people, right? And so that is not just a position for me, but it's a position for someone else. And maybe it's about creating your position, right? Which she also talked a lot about, right? And so, so I think that's it. This is a solid, my individual move is a community move as well. And
yeah.
So, yeah. And then I do think there is an element of that in moving in these circles, you do ask for things. And if not, if you don't get it and if you don't see something you like, you create it, right? And our peoples are creative people. And so, like, tap into that. So,
yeah. If the position doesn't exist, then
here's an idea.
Make it. Exactly.
Right.
Awesome. Great interview.
We trying to stay woke at work. We trying to stay woke at work. How about you? You trying to stay woke at work? If you trying to stay woke at work, stay true, stay true. We trying to stay woke at work. We trying to stay woke at work. How about you? You trying to stay woke at work? Woke at work, woke at work. Stay true, stay true.
Shout out to the North Star for making Woke at Work possible. If you are not a member of the North Star, you can head over to thenorthstar.com, create an account, and enjoy some of the paid content in addition to the free content that we offer. Thank you to the thousands of members who currently support this work that make this podcast, other podcasts, and all types of media that we offer, Speaking Truth to Power, possible. So again, that's thenorthstar.com. We really appreciate your support. I also want to thank Lysandra, our podcasting director, Willis, our producer, who is also responsible for this awesome music, as well as Tone and everyone else behind the scenes who make this podcast work.